Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Work in Digital Humanities, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Lucas Scholz. I'm a lecturer in digital humanities at the University of Manchester, and this is a new series that I'm setting up together with several colleagues to create a forum to discuss new books and book-length projects with a substantial digital component from across the humanities. Today I talk with Johanna Drucker. She's the Breslauer Professor of Bibliographical Studies in the Department of Information Studies at the University of California at Los Angeles. And she's internationally known for her work in the history of graphic design, of typography, experimental typography, so poetry, fine art, and the digital humanities. The book we talk about is her most recent book, Visualization and Interpretation, Humanistic Approaches to Display, which came out with MIT Press just last month. And it's an interrogation of visual epistemology in the digital humanities, a very diverse field with one of its perhaps most salient commonalities being its heavy reliance on visualization. And where charts and maps are often considered to be straightforward expressions of data, this book questions this relationship and argues that the kind of interpretative work that often happens in the humanities requires different forms of visual knowledge production. So welcome, Johanna.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. So before we talk about the book, could you maybe tell us something about yourself and your work more broadly and how this particular book fits in your trajectory?
Sure. My work began as creative writing. I always wanted to be a writer. And when I was in undergraduate school and art school and teaching myself to draw and learning to draw, I also had the opportunity to study typography, letterpress printing, and other forms of printmaking. And the encounter with the graphical impact of letterpress, of you know, alphabetic forms cast in metal and held in your hand, really brought home to me the relationship between visuality and semantic value in language. And that became a central tenet of the work that I was doing as a writer and a poet, and I printed letterpress books for 40 years. But I also went on doing drawing work and became increasingly interested in the way in which drawing as a way of seeing and knowing could provide insights into processes, procedures, as well as to be put at the service of abstract and formal languages that were notational and analytic. All of that came to my work in digital humanities when I arrived at the University of Virginia in 1999, having taught art history for about 14, 15 years and studio art before that. And what struck me in the digital humanities community, which was thriving and very vibrant at Virginia, really a kind of cutting edge community, was the lack of engagement with visuality and graphicality. People were doing projects of long standing with considerable intellectual labor and investment, but without even considering what an interface would be into that work, for instance. And at the moment that they would sit down to start thinking about an interface, they thought of it more as a kind of accessory or add-on rather than as a work of conceptual engineering that was about knowledge design and the, you know, instantiation of thought forms and arguments and rhetoric within graphical form. So it was in that context that my background in visual epistemology, which is really the strain that unites all of my scholarly work, as well as a lot of my creative work, began to be put into dialogue with digital projects. And it was an opportunity to innovate and imagine possibilities that are still showing up in this current book publication.
Right. So I think in the introduction, you mentioned that you are hopeful for this book to be an intervention at a specific moment for the digital humanities. So could you say something about what specifically is, could you maybe elaborate a little bit on that?
Sure. Digital humanities has matured tremendously. And I think one of the consequences of this, which has, you know, benefits and liabilities, is that the kinds of tools that are available for analysis, processing, and display across multiple disciplines and forms of, you know, and sort of forms of data, whether it's in, you know, history, sociology, history of science, the arts, literature, and so forth. These tools and platforms have become somewhat standard. And that means that one doesn't need a lot of specialized knowledge to make use of them. Wonderful tools. I think about something like Voyant that was developed by the late Stephen Sinclair and continuing work with Jeffrey Rockwell. And, you know, it's this amazing platform. You can take your literary works and your data and begin to generate graphical, displays for analysis and engage with the problems of topic modeling and of word frequency and so forth. But what's lost in the process is the ability to conceptualize from the outset how visualization might work as a representational or analytic or productive tool or platform. And so we have these black box standard, tools and platforms, but less and less do we conceptualize the tools. I mean, there are people who do that, the people who make innovations in all of these different domains. But for the most part, the suite of visualization types is pretty well fixed. And I mean, we could go through a list of them, but you would know them. It's pretty well fixed. And the sense that display follows data rather than being a site for creative imaginative intervention has also become part of the standard formulaic, procedures within digital humanities. So my hope is that we could begin to, open up the possibilities for visualization to be a site of knowledge production, not merely an instrument, a kind of mechanism for display of already modeled or created data.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about the book then. What would you say are the key contributions of your book?
Sure. Well, there's a number of different ideas in the book that I've been working with, again, for about 20 years. Some of the ideas here have their kind of kernel origin in the first projects that I did at Virginia, in particular, the project called Temporal Modeling. And that project, like much of the kind of conceptual framework of this book, had to do with thinking about what's the relationship between interpretation and visuality. How can we enable that relationship to really be dynamic, and how can we understand it critically as an intervention in knowledge, not just again an intervention in display? So you can imagine all kinds of really interesting displays, but the point is that unless they are actually thought through in terms of key concepts that come out of the humanities, they will continue to simply be these, again, mechanistic instruments. So when I say key concepts in the humanities that intersect with visualization, I mean a number of things. First of all, I'm really interested in what is graphical knowledge? I mean, what is visual epistemology? How is visuality a primary mode of knowledge production? How do we understand it? And, you know, the very simple demonstrations of this when you're, you know, teaching in the classroom are something like, you know, put two words on the board, right? Write two words on the board and then move one closer to the other. That act of creating proximity produces tension. It produces a dynamic. So, you know, what does proximity mean? How do we read something like proximity, hierarchy, sequencing, ordering, scale? All of those features are graphical and they carry semantic value in themselves as a graphical code. So that's one of the fundamental principles that have been, you know, it's not my principle. I mean, it's certainly present within, you know, formal analyses of visual work in art history and in Gestalt psychology and in visual semiotics. But it, in spite of there being a considerable literature and knowledge base in this field, this kind of approach to visual knowledge has not integrated successfully into the humanities disciplines. So that's one core concept. Within that, there are another set of concepts. For instance, what is the nature of interpretation and probabilistic interpretation in a dynamic relationship between provocation and experience? And again, this is a model of interpretation that comes out of 20th century philosophy. It's not my invention. But again, it pushes back against a kind of literalness that tends to come into digital processing activity, in which the notion that somehow a visualization simply is a statement, right? But it's not a statement, it's an argument. And what's the difference between a declarative statement and a probabilistic argument? How does interpretation work in relationship to human users, viewers, and readers? So there's, again, a model of interpretation here. So graphicality and interpretation are two of the key concepts. In addition, I'm interested in what I call non-representational approaches to visualization, and that sounds counterintuitive. How can an image not be representational? All images seem to be pictures of something or signs for something. But the concept of non-representational image production comes out of the work of Nigel Thrift and other geographers who are looking at the ways in which the production of images as a way to record experience, to show experience, these modes do not depend upon a kind of prior concept already being put into a relationship with a surrogate, but instead it's the making of the mark, it's the making of the sign, it's the making of the image that actually is the act of knowledge production. So again, graphicality, interpretation, non-representational approaches to image, which simply means let image making be a primary site of knowledge production. And then I'm also really interested in the concept of enunciation, which comes out of linguistics. And enunciation is simply the, you know, sort of analysis of the ways in which subject positionality is structured into articulation. When I speak to you, I address a you who is positioned in relationship to the speaking I. And that structure is a social dynamic, a political dynamic, a linguistic dynamic. And my argument is it's also present in graphicality, that the front-facing appearance of images on a screen, the classic interface with its, you know, sort of alignment with that frontal plane, performs an enunciative act, and that there's a kind of politics to looking at the ways in which power structures are hidden, concealed, and also instrumentalized in those environments. So I would say, you know, that those four concepts, graphicality as knowledge, interpretation as a fundamental aspect of humanistic relationship to knowledge, non-representational approaches that allow visuality to be a primary site for knowledge production, and enunciation, which is a way to look at the kind of power politics of graphical forms. Those would probably be the four crucial concepts in the work. That's probably my
right.
Work.
Yeah. 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 No. That was yeah. So one thing that struck me when reading the book is that it is a book about visualization and visual forms of knowledge, but throughout the main chapters of the book, there is actually there is no visualizations, and then you have this appendix for the book where you have where you show different design concepts and kind of exemplify some of the points that you make. Could you say something about that choice to in a sense to I don't want to say relegate, but to place those the visual component at the end of the book?
To be honest, I'm not sure that was my decision.
Okay.
So I think there's this kind of sense that was the gallery, that was the appendix. I'm not sure it's, you know, I mean, I think, you know, if I were to take responsibility for that and say, you know, that there was a reason for sort of making that separation, you know, it would be hard for me to find a strong argument for it. I mean, I wouldn't myself teach that way, because again, I'm interested in the ways in which direct engagement with visuality produces
right. Insight. Yeah. I mean, could you say something about where those? I mean, I think you said it in the book as well that some of these drafts and some of these images come out of various projects that you have been part of over the year, and one that seems to come up quite a lot is I think it was called 3DH.
Uh huh.
Could you say something about that?
Oh, sure. 3DH was lots of fun. 3DH is a project that was sponsored by and initiated by Jan Christoph Meister at the University of Hamburg. And he had, you know, received funds to try to look at the future of visualization in the humanities. And he's a narratologist, and of course, narratology is a wonderful humanistic endeavor because it's so nuanced in the way that it looks at the relationship between the plane of discourse and the plane of reference, you know, the telling and the told, and therefore is premised on these very notions of interpretation that are central to my own sort of approach to visuality and knowledge. And so he had said, oh, would you be interested in coming and working with us for a while to think about how we could advance visualizations in the humanities? And so I went and worked with him and his team and wonderful people there, you know, Marco Petrus and Rabea Clayman and Evelyn Geiss and Jeffrey Rockwell joined us. And we had other incredible visitors, Florian Windhagen and Laura Mandel. But, you know, our project really was to try to conceptualize visualizations that would work with a markup scheme that he and his team had developed called CATMA, which is a quite elaborate but graphically enabled way to do text analysis for narrative purposes. So we worked together for about 3 months in the spring of 2016. And though the project, you know, sort of got, you know, only to a certain point, as projects sometimes will, it was an opportunity really for me to develop a suite of graphical concepts that I could at least, you know, put into sketches and drawings. And those graphical concepts drew on modes of visual production that are not part of the digital humanities at this point, but come out of the conventions of architectural drawing, mathematical drawing, perspectival drawing. In other words, my argument was, why don't we expand our vocabulary of visualization types beyond the charts, graphs, pie charts, network diagrams, and, you know, whisker bar, you know, diagrams and such that really were developed for the natural sciences and social sciences. Why not draw on the traditions of the arts to see what we could do, not just to make more interesting images, but to expand concepts. So very simply, for instance, what does it mean to put a point of view system into a visualization? We're completely used to it and, you know, from the history of art, to see the situated point of view of someone in whose point of view the image is produced. And yet we never do this in visualizations. And again, going back to what we did in Virginia, starting with temporal modeling and then with a project we did called Ivanhoe, we being the speculative computing lab that I founded with my colleague, Jerome McGann, we introduced a point of view system into the interface with the idea that the game of Ivanhoe, which was a game of interpretation and literary play, should always only be seen from the point of view of someone. It should always be owned. It should always be claimed. No omniscient point of view. So, you know, a concept that is instantiated in a set of graphical conventions isn't just a kind of augmentation of pictures or an addition of pictorial kind of devices. It's a conceptual intervention in the understanding of how visualizations produce knowledge. And that was a lot of what, you know, became distilled in the course of doing the 3DH project.
Right. So, and you said the project, it only lasted so long, and didn't continue then. But do you envisage to continue some of the work developed there in terms of, I don't know, even developing maybe a tool or a platform that incorporates some of those?
I'm sorry. Yes. In fact, I've had a project here. I mean, I get distracted because I have some other things to do from time to time. It's busy. But I've been working here with a couple of doctoral students on a project that's called Heterochronologies. And it's, making use of some of these tools and also pushing the temporal modeling project forward again. I mean, these are projects I've worked on off and on for years and would really like to see turned into a platform. So Heterochronologies, for instance, is a project that tries to think about how making the specificity of difference across ontologies visible could be put at the service of humanistic work. So, you know, timelines, chronologies, Comtist schemes, and so forth that come out of the history of human culture and across cultures don't match, right? They're different in length, structure, units, metrics, calendar schemes, and so forth. And rather than thinking about reconciling these to a single overarching unified system, Uber crosswalk kind of phenomenon, the notion would be to create an environment where, comparison and correlation would expose the specifics of the relationships among these schema. And so we developed a thing we call Time Capsule that is a space for doing that kind of comparative work. Now, we haven't built a back end. We've been working a lot on conceptualizing the way this works for users and viewers. And said my two collaborators here, Peter Pollack and Pietro Santacchiera, have been engaged in helping to, you know, do the research and conceptualization and visualizations and put this forward. And so there's lots of work to be done and, you know, possibilities. And I would love to see some of the kind of more imaginative features from the 3DH project be able to be implemented. There's no reason that they couldn't be. I just haven't devoted my time to it. In the last couple of years, I was, as I said, busy with various projects.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini,
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, so another thing that I'm interested in, and I guess it would be too early to, I guess, to ask about reception of this book because it just came out last month. But you mentioned that a lot of these ideas are not things that you have been working on for years. So I would be curious if you could say something about your your interactions with the data visualization community, and then maybe also with more critical communities, like I think you mentioned critical geographers,
right?
Or critical data studies.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I have to say that, one of the things that's interesting within the humanities, I'll start there before I move to the visualization folks and other critical, communities of critical practice. But in the humanities, there has been a longstanding resistance to visuality as a primary mode of knowledge production. I mean, we have the art historians and we have the architectural, folks who understand visuality and its role. But to a great extent, people in a text-based community, and this was certainly true for me in my life among the poets in the 1970s and 80s when I was first doing, graphically scoring poetic works, and then was true in, literary studies, is that there's just a kind of, distrust of the visual, as if it trivializes the authority of the word. And, this has longstanding sort of connections to the sort of theology of text within Western culture. I think it's very different in Asian culture, where calligraphic production of text is considered integral to the affective dimensions of communication. Strong resistance. And then when we started playing with the, sort of concept of temporal modeling at Virginia and wanted to assert the idea that visuality was a primary mode of knowledge production, that you could make a mark and another mark and that would produce data and that was a way of making an argument, it met with a lot of resistance. And the resistance came from a couple of directions. One was, and with good reason, a recognition of the fundamental instability of the graphical sign, right? I mean, this is a fact of visuality, which is that visual signs are not doubly articulated the way that linguistic ones are. And so there's no semiotic set. There's no fundamental elements in the visual, in the visual compositional system. And so it's like, what's the basic unit? What's the basic unit of an image? Is it a stroke? Is it a mark? Is it a blotch? Is it a color? Is it what? I think there was, a nervousness about that. And then there was a nervousness about the idea of interpretation versus empiricism. Part of what the digital humanities was ready to work with was what kinds of analytics can be performed on humanistic work that conform to the methods of empiricism that are being borrowed by appropriating statistical analysis, numerical analysis, and quantitative methods. So the whole notion of disambiguation that's essential for computational processing just seemed to, have a kind of authority to it that didn't fit comfortably with the idea of probabilistic interpretation. It's like, whoa, no, don't do that to us. We want, please. So that made people uncomfortable. So you combine visuality and, probability. And it's like, so there was that kind of resistance. fine. I mean, so what? You carry on, right? But little by little, I think, in particular, the concepts of CAPTA and the idea of visuality as a primary site for engagement with analysis have had more and more traction. And that's not just because of me. I think it's because as visualizations have become more and more prolific and more familiar, because they can be produced out of an Excel sheet, you know, I mean, they can be produced quite easily. I think people are more and more, you know, sort of comfortable with the idea that, oh, this is something we should be looking at, using, thinking about critically. And in the data visualization community, of course, there's some, you know, really wonderful work. I mean, there's, you know, there's the work of Lauren Klein and Catherine D'Ignazio, feminist data visualization. There's the, you know, work of Yanni Lukisis on All Data Are Local, his visualizations. I know it's really sophisticated, you know, interesting work. And, you know, work like Tom Carden's work that, you know, plays with distortions of space according to factors of time. So, but it's really the cartographers who were most influential on me because of, again, the kind of affective dimensions of spatial production and their presentation in graphical form. It's like, you know, a cultural geographer will say two different people do not inhabit the same space differently. They inhabit different spaces. They construct different spaces. And again, you can think about this on, in terms of like urban street experience, right? It's like, if you're, you know, if your demographics, you know, read one way, your relationship to that space is completely different than it is if your demographics are distinct from that. And, you know, women live in a different world than men. I will tell you that when it comes to urban space, you know, it's like, it's not that we inhabit the same space differently. The space itself is different. And again, that's a constructivist approach to knowledge. There are very few data visualizations that embody constructivist principles. And this, again, is one of my, you know, sort of like someday I will manage to do this with the right team of folks and to show how that is the case. And so the data visualization people, the strict data visualization people now, not the kind of, you know, subset that is the intersection with the humanists, but the strict data visualization people, you know, have gotten more and more interested. I was invited to be a keynote speaker at the IEEE conference up in Vancouver about a year ago in their visualization, you know, the visualization subsection. And I got there and I started going to the different, you know, sessions in advance of my talk. And, you know, these are really super technical, very skilled, trained, you know, folks who are working with things like, you know, well, if we have a cluster amalgam that represents the sigma, you know, sort of factor, how can we optimize the kind of distribution, you know, graph in order to, you know, efficiently display the, you know, 12 factor, you know, you see, you know.
Yeah.
I'm sitting there in these sessions and I'm thinking, what am I doing here? Like, why would these people want to talk to me? And yet I have to say, when I gave my talk, which was about humanistic, you know, approaches to visualization, you know, it was a room of over 1,000 people and they were enthused. I was like, that's incredible. You know, I think there's a recognition that the affective dimensions of human experience have a role to play in data modeling and in visualization and its expression. And I'll give you an example, because again, this comes out of our temporal modeling work. And that is that if you're modeling a crisis event, and supposing you have, you know, a natural disaster that's imminent, and or a natural disaster that's unfolding, and, you know, the consequences of that are imminent, and they have to do with, say, a dam breaking, a school being at risk of being flooded and washed away, emergency equipment needing to be deployed, crews that need to be scheduled, multiple temporal, sort of streams that all have to be coordinated, but where the data feed is not synchronous, right? It's intermittent on different cycles. But you also have the fact that adrenaline produces different kinds of perceptions of temporality in different, within the physiological, sort of experience of individuals. And so you have these multiple different aspects of the way in which temporalities need to be correlated that take into account the affective, in the real almost physiological sense of it, dimension of times unfolding. Well, how do you model that? And how does visualization help to support decision-making processes at crucial junctures with enough time window in them to be able to have a successful outcome? So, it's like, I think people see that, affective dimensions of experience are not incidental to data visualization, but are important to it. But some of the data visualization people, and I won't name names, it doesn't matter, are quite resistant to these ideas and data visualization came out of a kind of optimization of consumer satisfaction mode. And, it's like, how do you help people get what they think they want? Right, whether they're filtering for an airline ticket, or they're looking at restaurant reviews, or they're trying to buy their favorite, chocolate online, whatever it is. And so that model of interface and a visualization is very consumer oriented. It's not interested in the production of subjectivity, nor should it be necessarily. Right, it's got a different purpose right. to it. One of the wonderful domains of critical intervention, I think, has been, an understanding of hand-drawn data. The wonderful project by Stephanie Posevec and her partner in the project, whose name I forget, which is unfortunate. But the Dear Data Project is very engaging, and I think, allowed a whole bunch of people to suddenly see possibilities in non-standard data visualizations that inspired imagination. So that's a terrific project. I think the work that Laura Kurgan was doing on the $1 million blocks years ago, work that's come out of Marin Dork's lab in Potsdam and other places, they're really interesting, sort of projects or groups of people who are trying to think about the as yet unrealized potential of visualization to engage with broader vocabularies and therefore broader conceptual frameworks and inputs.
Right. Yeah. No. That's fascinating, and it's interesting that IEEE people invited you to them.
I thought so too. But again, I was very surprised at the reception. That there was a real openness. And for instance, one of the things I was talking about was the notion of the enunciative interface. I said, is there a way that we can create interfaces that, number one, expose the life cycle of data? Right, because it's one of the big problems is that you arrive at a visualization and it simply appears to be a presentation of a statement of fact, a statement of what is. But in fact, it's a complex representation that's a remediation of modeled data that's extracted from a phenomena. The model is lost. You can't see it. You don't know what was eliminated, cleaned up, smoothed. It's like all that's erased. And so I said, this is something that has an ethical dimension to it within, news and informatics and pandemic management and so forth. And somebody who's from a very important, again, I won't say what, but a very important, visualization platform said, yeah, we agree. And we're trying to work on this, right? And it was like, great, you know, this is fantastic. So I think the problems that I've identified are in many ways, you know, problems that other people are aware of. It's just that I think I'm more interested in pushing against the received conventions than not. You know, it's interesting to me to think, how do forms constrain knowledge?
Yeah.
And how can we think beyond the conventions that, you know, we internalize as if they are full explanations for how to think? So I was raised in a tradition of radical skepticism, and I just kind of can't let go of it. You know, it's like, I'm sure there's something we're not thinking yet. I'm sure there's some way to think about this that we haven't yet. And again, I think because visualizations play such a huge role in our current existence.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know about you, but I'm always looking at the pandemic statistics.
Oh, yeah.
And trying to understand them. And, you know, they play out in these kinds of bar charts, but we know the bar charts are, you know, sort of aggregate reductions of complex phenomena.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this whole pandemic has been one big, I guess, teachable moment, as they call it, when it comes to
for all of this kind of big data processing and
also the interaction, yeah, the ubiquity of charts and visual ways of engaging with
what's
happening.
Yeah, no, and you know, I mean, we do not actually have adequate visual conventions for showing many of the kinds of phenomena that we want to show. And in particular, the complexity of data. And of the modeling processes that go into their production.
So is this something you are planning to continue working on, or what are you working on now? What will be your next major project?
Well, I've had a bunch of projects this year. It's been a year of kind of finishing up work that's had very long life cycles to it. I just published a book with Johns Hopkins University Press about a figure named Ilya Zdenievich, who was a Russian futurist Zaum, transmental poetry writer and typographer, who became a publisher of Livre d'Artiste and designer, lived in Paris most of his adult life. And this is a project I started in 1985, it's now out. It was a biography of Zdenievich and his work, but it's now a metabiography that reflects on biographical processes. It's not specifically about visuality, though the books are very visual and graphic and highly structured in their own formal instantiation. But it's a book that has much resonance with this other work because it is about the relationship between evidence and interpretation, you know, knowledge and story, cultural processes of history and their relationship to, you know, how we understand an individual life and culture, but also because they're about books, because Ilya has made these fantastic works. They ask the question of how an object like a book is limited in the way it can actually tell its own story. So in that sense, it's not that different from saying an information visualization doesn't have the tools in it to reveal the processes of its production, the decision, right? The social conditions of its conception and execution. So anyway, that book is very dear to my heart, and in part because of the relationships with people that were fostered by that research. Again, starting in the cold January winter of 1985, when I met the widow of Ilya Zdenievich in this tiny little apartment in Paris, and she invited me in, and I'm sitting in this little, you know, room with her next to a flickering gas fire, and I'm looking around and realizing, oh, I am surrounded by major works of modern art. There's a portrait by Natalia Goncharova and one by Robert Delaunay, and there's a collage by Picasso. And I'm like, oh, I can't believe I'm sitting in this little room, humble little room, like this tiny little studio apartment. Anyway, so that's a project very dear to my heart. And then I have a book on digital humanities, the course book that I've rewritten that will be coming out in March. And then I'm finishing up another project of like long, long standing, which is my study of the history of knowledge about the alphabet and its origins, which I started in different ways 40 years ago. I wrote another book about the alphabet that was published by Thames and Hudson in the 90s about the alphabet as a visual form. But this book is really about the intellectual tradition within which knowledge about the alphabet developed and different technologies of knowledge production, textual, bibliographical, graphical, antiquarian, paleographic, and archaeological, and how we come to understand something as miraculous and, complex as the alphabet within this intellectual lineage. So that project is now under contract, and I'm editing and working on it. So you can see why I haven't had all that much time doing the visualizations, but I don't know. I'll get back to them. You know, they never go away. I just haven't made the production of the actual platform a primary research project. It's okay. I mean, somebody else can do it. I'm fine with that. But I do have some folks that I've been in touch with who are interested in collaboration, and they are people who are capable of doing this work. So if the opportunity arises to actually create a working prototype of, the comparative ontologies, heterochronologies, temporal modeling environment, that would be fantastic, because it would demonstrate how these principles have application in various kinds of humanistic and cultural undertakings.
Right. Yeah. Well, that sounds like an exciting scholarly agenda ahead.
Yeah. No, it'd be fun. There's the great fun of working with people it's such a fascinating process to take, concepts and watch the ways in which consensus understanding develops through conversation and exchange. And, that's crucial to the development of anything that will actually be able to be used. Because if it's just some, strange, peculiar, oh, Drucker again idea, but if it can be made to function. And again, I'll finish maybe with this very nice anecdote, because we were very inspired, we being Peter and Pietro and I, by a conversation that we had with Yanni Lukisis recently. And he was talking to us about the Map Room project and how it works. And it's, this set of projections and, tables covered with paper and people in communities coming together and drawing. And again, it's very much a demonstration of this kind of non-representational, experiential, engagement with space and communities and neighborhoods and so forth. And I said, this is what sort of moved our thinking for the chronologies project forward into a way that was like very graphic and very like, graspable. And I went to see some old friends of mine recently, and they were talking about having a conversation with their grandchildren. And the grandchildren, they said something about some event, and the grandchildren looked at them like, the Civil War, like, what was that, World War what, And so the grandparents were, of course, very disturbed by this. It's like, oh, these children today, they know nothing. And so they put a big piece of paper out on the table, and they said, okay, let's just play a game here. What's the earliest thing you can think of in history? And that they'll put it down here at this end. Now, what's the most recent thing? And we'll put it over here at this end. So immediately, spatialization becomes part of the graphical investigation of history. And then they had the kids start to name different kinds of events, anything they could think of, you know, whether it was the discovery of America or, you know, the moon landing or, you know, their first birthday. And they began to put this into this large schema of this space on the table and to begin to grapple with the different scales, the different metrics. You know, when did dinosaurs roam the earth? How long before your first birthday? You know, it's like, what kind of time scales do you need to begin to understand that? And so that kind of engagement, which just seems so rewarding, like the kids just got completely absorbed. They were like, you know, into history suddenly because it was participatory. It was visible. It was cognitively graspable because of the way that they were actively participating in decisions about where do I place it? What is its relationship to other events? And what does that mean about the, you know, time scales of history? So, you know, so that kind of pushed us towards our time capsule concept because, again, it's suddenly useful in all kinds of ways.
Right. Well, that's a fantastic, that's a nice anecdote to end this with.
Yeah.
So thank you. Thank you so much for joining me for the interview.
Well, thank you so much for having me.